This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of pediatric osteomyelitis from the pediatric section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Osteomyelitis in the pediatric population is most often the result of hematogenous seeding of bacteria to the metaphyseal region of bone. Diagnosis is generally made with MRI studies to evaluate for bone marrow edema or subperiosteal abscess. Treatment is non-operative with antibiotics in the absence of an abscess. Surgical debridement is indicated in the presence of an abscess. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, the incidence of pediatric osteomyelitis is 1 in 5,000 children younger than 13 years old. As far as demographics, the mean age of pediatric osteomyelitis is 6.6 years. It's 2.5 times more common in boys. It's more common in the first decade of life due to the rich metaphyseal blood supply and immature immune system. And it's not uncommon in healthy children. In terms of anatomic location, pediatric osteomyelitis is typically metaphyseal via hematogenous seeding. Risk factors for pediatric osteomyelitis include diabetes mellitus, hemoglobinopathy, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, chronic renal disease, immune compromise, and varicella infection. Moving on to etiology, with respect to pathophysiology, the mechanism of pediatric osteomyelitis is local trauma and bacteremia that leads to increased susceptibility to bacterial seeding of the metaphysis. There is a history of trauma that is reported in 30% of patients. In terms of microbiology, the organisms to be aware of include Staph aureus, Group B strep, Kingella kingae, Pseudomonas, Haemophilus influenza, Mycobacteria tuberculosis, and Salmonella. Staph aureus is the most common organism in all children. Strains of community-acquired MRSA have genes encoding for pentan-valentine leukocytin or PVL cytotoxin. PVL-positive strains are more associated with complex infections, multifocal infections, prolonged fever, abscess, DVT, and sepsis. MRSA is associated with increased risk of DVT and septic emboli. Group B strep is the most common organism in neonates. Kingella kingae is becoming more common in younger age groups. Pseudomonas is associated with direct puncture wounds to the foot. Haemophilus influenza has become much less common with the advent of the Haemophilus influenza vaccine. If Mycobacteria tuberculosis is the etiology for pediatric osteomyelitis, children are more likely to have extrapulmonary involvement and know that biopsy with stains and culture for acid-fast bacilli is diagnostic. Finally, Salmonella is more common in sickle cell patients. Moving on to pathoanatomy, let's go over acute osteomyelitis versus chronic osteomyelitis. Most cases of acute osteomyelitis are hematogenous. Initial bacteremia may be from a skin lesion, infection, or even trauma from tooth brushing. In terms of microscopic activity in acute osteomyelitis, there is sluggish blood flow in the metaphyseal capillaries due to sharp turns resulting in venous sinusoids, which give bacteria time to lodge in this region. The low pH and low oxygen tension around the growth plate assist in the bacterial growth. Infection occurs after the local bone defenses have been overwhelmed by bacteria. Spread through the bone occurs via Haversian and Volkmann canal systems. Purulence develops in conjunction with osteoblast necrosis, osteoclast activation, the release of inflammatory mediators, and blood vessel thrombosis. As far as macroscopic activity in the setting of acute osteomyelitis, a subperiosteal abscess develops when the purulence breaks through the metaphyseal cortex. Septic arthritis develops when the purulence breaks through an intraarticular metaphyseal cortex, such as the hip, shoulder, elbow, ankle, and note not the knee, as this joint does not have an intraarticular metaphyseal cortex. Infants less than 1 year of age can have an infection spread across the growth plate via capillaries, causing osteomyelitis in the epiphysis and septic arthritis. Moving on to chronic osteomyelitis, know that periosteal elevation deprives the underlying cortical bone of blood supply, leading to necrotic bone, otherwise known as a sequestrum. Sequestrum is the necrotic bone which has become walled off from its blood supply and can present as a nidus for chronic osteomyelitis. An outer layer of new bone is formed by the periosteum and is known as the involucrum. The involucrum is a layer of new bone growth outside existing bone seen in osteomyelitis. Chronic abscesses may become surrounded by sclerotic bone and fibrous tissue, leading to a Brody's abscess. Now, let's quickly talk about some relevant anatomy, specifically about the blood supply. Know that the metaphyseal blood capillaries undergo sharp turns prior to entering venous sinusoids, leading to turbulent flow and predisposition of bacterial deposition. As far as the classification of pediatric osteomyelitis, there's acute osteomyelitis, subacute osteomyelitis, and chronic osteomyelitis. Since we talked about acute osteomyelitis and chronic osteomyelitis just now, let's talk about subacute osteomyelitis. And this is an uncommon infection with bone pain and radiographic changes without systemic symptoms. There is increased host resistance, decreased organ virulence, and/or prior antibiotic exposure. As far as the radiographic classification, types 1A and 1B show lucency, type 2 is a metaphyseal lesion with cortical bone loss, type 3 is a diaphyseal lesion, type 4 shows onion skinning, type 5 is an epiphyseal lesion, and type 6 is a spinal lesion. Now let's talk about the presentation of pediatric osteomyelitis. These patients will typically have a history of limb pain, recent local infection or trauma, be sure to obtain immunization history regarding Haemophilus influenza, and ask about prior antibiotic use as it may mask the symptoms. Symptoms of pediatric osteomyelitis can include limp or refusal to bear weight. These patients are generally not toxic appearing, and they may or may not have a fever. On physical exam, in terms of inspection and palpation, you may find an edematous, warm, swollen, tender limb, and be sure to evaluate for point tenderness in the pelvis, spine, or limbs. As far as range of motion, these patients will have restricted motion due to pain. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include an AP and a lateral of the suspected area. Findings on early films may be normal or show loss of soft tissue planes and soft tissue edema. New periosteal bone formation happens in 5 to 7 days, osteolysis happens in 10 to 14 days, and late films, defined as 1 to 2 weeks, show metaphyseal rarefaction, that is, reduction in the metaphyseal bone density or possible abscess. A CT scan is more helpful later in the disease course to demonstrate bone changes or abscesses. An MRI detects abscesses and early marrow and soft tissue edema. As far as indications, an MRI can assist with decision-making when there's a poor clinical response to antibiotics or when surgical drainage is considered. As far as findings of pediatric osteomyelitis on MRI on the different views, the T1 signal is decreased, T1 with gadolinium signal is increased, and T2 signal is also increased. Know that there's an 88% to 100% sensitivity, and remember that sensitivity is increased by gadolinium contrast. A bone scan can be indicated when there's a non-diagnostic x-ray and there is a need to localize the pathology in an infant or a toddler with a non-focal exam. Technetium-99 can localize the focus of infection and show a multifocal infection. This has 92% sensitivity, and know that a cold bone scan may be associated with more aggressive infections. As far as the studies to obtain in the workup of pediatric osteomyelitis, serum labs should include a white blood cell count, C-reactive protein, ESR, plasma procalcitonin. You may also consider a bone aspiration and blood culture. White blood cell count is elevated in 25% of patients and correlates poorly with treatment response. C-reactive protein is elevated in 98% of patients with acute hematogenous osteomyelitis. It becomes elevated within 6 hours. It is the most sensitive to monitor therapeutic response. It declines rapidly as the clinical picture improves, and CRP is the best indicator of early treatment success and normalizes within a week. Failure of the C-reactive protein to decline after 48 to 72 hours of treatment should indicate that treatment may need to be altered. ESR is elevated in 90% of patients with osteomyelitis. It rises rapidly and peaks in 3 to 5 days, but declines too slowly to guide treatment. It is less reliable in neonates and sickle cell patients. Plasma procalcitonin is a new serologic test that rises rapidly with a bacterial infection but remains low in viral infections and other inflammatory situations. It is elevated in 58% of pediatric osteomyelitis cases. Bone aspiration helps establish a definitive diagnosis. 50% to 70% of affected patients have positive cultures. Blood cultures are positive only 30 to 50% of the time and will likely be negative soon after antibiotics are administered, even if treatment is not progressing satisfactorily. Aspiration assists in diagnosis and management. It helps guide antibiotic selection when the organism is identified 50% of the time, and you can proceed with surgical drainage if pus is aspirated. The technique involves a large bore needle that is utilized to aspirate the subperiosteal and intraosseous spaces under fluoroscopic or CT guidance. You can then start antibiotics after the aspiration. As far as biopsy and culture, consider this when the diagnosis is not clear, for example, in the setting of subacute osteomyelitis, and also when you need to rule out malignancy. Moving on to treatment, pediatric osteomyelitis can be treated non-operatively or operatively. Non-operative management includes antibiotic therapy alone, which is indicated in early disease with no subperiosteal abscess or abscess within the bone. Surgery is not indicated if there's clinical improvement obtained within 48 hours. As far as antibiotic modalities, begin with empiric therapy. Generally, this is nafcillin or oxacillin, unless there's high local prevalence of MRSA, then use clindamycin or vancomycin. The mechanism of action for vancomycin involves binding to the D-ala-D-ala moiety in bacterial cell walls. If the Gram stain shows Gram-negative bacilli, add a third-generation cephalosporin. You can then convert to organism-specific antibiotics if the organism is identified. If the organism is Mycobacterium tuberculosis, treatment for the initial 1 year is multi-agent antibiotics and rarely surgical debridement due to the risk of chronic sinus formation. As far as duration of antibiotic therapy, pediatric osteomyelitis is typically treated with IV antibiotics for 4 to 6 weeks. However, this is a controversial duration. As far as intravenous versus oral antibiotics, this is often a case-by-case decision with input from infectious disease consultation. Operative treatment for pediatric osteomyelitis includes surgical drainage, debridement, and antibiotic therapy. This is indicated in the setting of deep or subperiosteal abscess, failure to respond to antibiotics, and in the setting of chronic infection. Contraindications include hemodynamic instability, as patients should be stabilized first. However, sometimes operative treatment of the underlying infection helps stabilize the patient. Be sure to review an example of an institution algorithm treatment pathway for osteomyelitis on orthobullets.com or on the Bullets mobile app. Now, let's quickly go over the technique of surgical drainage, debridement, and antibiotic therapy in a bit more detail. So in terms of the soft tissue, evaluate all purulents, debride the devitalized tissue, and drill as needed into the intraosseous collections. Send the tissue for culture and pathology to rule out neoplasm. Then you will close the wound over drains or pack and return to the OR in 2 to 3 days. In terms of bone work, be sure to remove the sequestrum in chronic cases. Now let's go over some complications of pediatric osteomyelitis, and the ones to know include DVT, meningitis, septic arthritis, growth disturbances and limb length discrepancies from growth plate involvement, and pathologic fractures. So starting with DVT, as far as incidence, this is an infrequent complication in children. Risk factors include a CRP greater than 6, surgical treatment, age greater than 8 years old, and a MRSA infection. The treatment will be therapeutic anticoagulation. Moving on to septic arthritis, as far as risk factors, bones with an intra-articular metaphysis are at risk, such as the shoulder, elbow, hip, and ankle. Again, remember the knee does not have an intra-articular metaphysis. Other risk factors for septic arthritis includes neonates. Treatment for septic arthritis is irrigation and debridement. Finally, moving on to growth disturbances and limb length discrepancies from growth plate involvement, the treatment will be observation and possible corrective surgery depending on the severity or projected severity. Now, to end this review session, just a quick word on the prognosis of pediatric osteomyelitis. The mortality is decreased from 50% to less than 1% since the development of antibiotics. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. First question. Which of the following joints is at the lowest risk for concurrent septic arthritis in the setting of metaphyseal osteomyelitis in a pediatric patient? And the choices are 1, shoulder, 2, elbow, 3, hip, 4, knee, and 5, ankle. The correct answer to this question is 4, knee. So intracapsular metaphyses are located at the shoulder or the proximal humerus, elbow or the proximal radius, hip or the proximal femur, and ankle or the distal fibula. Septic arthritis of these joints can arise from metaphyseal osteomyelitis. To quickly review, pediatric metaphyses are predisposed to bacterial deposition due to the turbulent blood flow from sharp turns of capillaries prior to entering venous sinusoids. The risk of bacterial spread to a nearby joint is increased when the metaphysis is intracapsular. Early diagnosis and treatment are vital to prevent joint destruction and morbidity. Arkader et al. Reviewed pediatric musculoskeletal infections, including septic arthritis. The authors note that primary septic arthritis is the most common type of septic arthritis and results from hematogenous spread or direct inoculation. Secondary septic arthritis results from the spread of osteomyelitis in the joint and occurs when the metaphysis is intracapsular. Children are often younger than 2 years old, and the hip is reported as the most common location. The authors conclude that targeted antibiotic therapy and joint decompression, either open or arthroscopic, with debridement are the mainstay of treatment. Schallert et al. Retrospectively evaluated pediatric metaphyseal osteomyelitis to determine the role of various MRI findings in predicting coexisting septic arthritis. The authors found joint effusions in 55 cases of metaphyseal osteomyelitis, that is 53% of the patients studied, and 41 of which had surgically confirmed septic arthritis, or 40% of the patients studied. They conclude patients with a joint effusion identified by MRI in the setting of metaphyseal osteomyelitis should be presumed to have septic arthritis until proven otherwise, particularly at sites of intra-articular metaphyses. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, shoulder, answer 2, elbow, answer 3, hip, and answer 5, ankle, are all incorrect, as these are all at increased risk of septic arthritis from concomitant spread from their respective intra-articular metaphyses. And moving on to the final question, which of the following statements regarding acute hematogenous osteomyelitis in pediatric patients is true? And the choices are 1, group A streptococcus is the most common infecting organism. 2, a history of trauma is reported in 20 to 40% of patients. 3, it typically occurs in the epiphysis via hematogenous seeding. 4, CT scan is the advanced imaging study of choice. And 5, blood cultures are positive in 75 to 80% of patients. The correct answer to this question is 2, a history of trauma is reported in 20 to 40% of patients. So bone and joint infections in children may be difficult to diagnose. The surgeon must look for physical findings such as skin changes and fluctuants for abscess formation. Osteomyelitis in pediatric patients typically affects the metaphysis via hematogenous seeding, with Staphylococcus aureus being the most common infecting organism. A history of trauma may be present in 20 to 40% of patients, while blood cultures may be positive in only 30 to 50% of patients. Morrissey et al. Published a study using rabbits to model trauma as an etiology for acute hematogenous osteomyelitis. They divided the rabbits into 3 different groups. Group 1 received an injury to the proximal tibial physeal plate. Group 2 received standardized bacteremia with Staphylococcus aureus. And group 3 received both the fracture and the bacteremia. They found that the animals with fracture and bacteremia developed significant osteomyelitis in almost all cases. Pendleton et al. Published a review on methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus bone and joint infections in children. They report that early use of MRI helps delineate the extent of the infection, aids in the consideration of surgery, and provides valuable information for surgical planning. They also report that trauma increases the chances of development of osteomyelitis when there is concurrent bacteremia. Deitch et al. Published a study on osteomyelitis in infants and children. They found that a history of trauma was reported in 35% of patients. They also found that boys were twice as often affected than girls, and that Staphylococcus aureus was the major etiologic agent, accounting for 61% of infections. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, Staphylococcus aureus, not group A streptococcus, is the most common infecting organism. Answer 3, it typically occurs in the epiphysis via hematogenous seeding, is incorrect, as osteomyelitis in pediatric patients typically affects the metaphysis, not the epiphysis, via hematogenous seeding. Answer 4, CT scan is the advanced imaging modality of choice, is incorrect, as CT scans are not the advanced imaging modality of choice in acute hematogenous osteomyelitis. MRI is typically the choice. And finally, answer 5, blood cultures are positive in 75 to 80% of patients, is incorrect, as blood cultures are positive in only 30 to 50% of patients, not 75 to 80%. That's all for this review about pediatric osteomyelitis. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.